The topic is the first of the skillful practices, and that is the practice of cultivating skillful qualities that have not yet risen. So cultivate those kind of qualities of mind that have not here yet. Help them to come forth and be here to support us. And the skillful qualities are those qualities of mind that lead to freedom from suffering, lead to our happiness, welfare, liberation. Is the volume okay for everyone? Can you hear okay? Okay. So in introducing this topic, I want to mention that sometimes in the Dharma practice, that things don't unfold in the way that we normally operate, the way normally think. It often requires a kind of different approach. And one analogy for this is, if you want to go somewhere, then often we think we want to go directly right there. But if you want to go from here to Los Angeles, drive to LA, which is about a few hundred miles away, and then the first thing you, if you want to do it efficiently, the first thing you want to do is drive north, not south, even though Los Angeles is to the south. Because I think the quickest way to get there is to go north on 17 and then down on 101 or something like that. Sometimes you go in the opposite direction you think. A little similar to that would be that if you're standing on your tippy toes and you want to leap really high, you're not going to get very far. If you want to leap high, you crouch first. You go in the opposite direction than you want to go. And then you get a spring, and then you can push off, and then you can maybe jump high. But if you're stretching for where you want to go, up in the air, on your tippy toes, you're not going to get very far. So one of the ways that many people operate is that they're in control, they're in charge, and I have to do certain things. Give me the recipe, tell me what to do, and I'll do it. And since I'm doing it, it better happen. And we're going to make it happen. We're going to, it's all up to us. In the Dharma, Dharma doesn't really work that way. The primary quality or characteristic of Dharma practice is setting in place the conditions that allow something to arise. So rather than being the one who makes things happen, we're the ones who create the conditions for something to arise. And the Buddha gave the analogy for this of a farmer who's growing plants. And the farmer does not cause the plants to grow. Rather, the farmer, when cultivating the crops, creates the conditions where the plants can grow for themselves. Fertilizer, maybe some water, you know, try to get rid of the pests or something, you know, all kinds of things I try to do. And with the ideal conditions, the plant can thrive. So in the same way, we try to create the best conditions possible for the plant of the Dharma, for the path of practice to arise within us. And so we become the path, we become the practice rather than making it. And we have a role. We can't be passive. It's not like you have to do it, can't do anything. There is a lot of effort that's needed in the practice, but it's not the effort to make something, but rather the effort to support, allow something to happen, to support something to arise, to create the conditions for something to be born within us. And in having this kind of approach, in my reading of the teachings of the Buddha, it's a very positive view of human nature. There's the assumption that somehow in our nature there are forces of goodness, forces of skillful forces, forces that want to operate, that lead us to freedom from suffering, that support us in that endeavor. And given the right conditions, those inner forces, those inner qualities, will come forth and support us and grow and develop. The Buddha described this in another way, another analogy, that of rainwater falling on the mountainside. The rain falls on the mountain, and if it's enough rain, then the rain begins to collect and make little streamlets, and then those become streams, and those become creeks, those become rivers, and eventually these major rivers that go out into the ocean. And in the same way, something begins the whole process, the rain, and then the gravity takes over. We create certain conditions, put ourselves in certain situations, and then the Buddha used the language of the practice flows from one thing to the next. And there are five things that he repeats over and over and over again that he describes kind of in this language of flowing or this natural arising, that you don't make these things happen, but they're born and they follow each other one after the other. And the first one is gladness, pamoja, to be glad. And maybe some of us don't use the word glad very often anymore. It's maybe a little archaic. But it's what English, what translators have chosen to use. Certain kind of delight or joy. But with certain conditions in place, the language, the word is gladness is born. It doesn't say, you know, you kind of like make it happen. Like you do the gladness thing. It says gladness arises, is born. When a person is glad, joy arises. When joy arises, the body becomes tranquil. When the body becomes tranquil, we become happy. Happiness arises. And when someone is happy, the mind gets concentrated. It's a very different feeling for getting concentrated than sitting here and huffing and puffing. And I suspect maybe a couple of you have been huffing and puffing. You know, you're feeling your mind's not concentrated enough, and if you just bear down and push harder and contract more and really kind of bear, you know, really make it, you're going to do it, you know. And you know. But here the concentration is not the result of making yourself concentrated, but rather putting together the conditions that support concentration to arise. And one of the concentrations is one of the conditions is not being grim. And I would say that not being too serious, if the seriousness is grim or, you know, dour or, you know, and heavy. Because the wrong kind of seriousness squashes any possibilities of being happy. So what supports happiness? And, what supports happiness is to be relaxed in your body. Let's try to relax. What supports relaxation? Some modicum of joy. What supports joy is some gladness, something that kind of inspires you. So that sequence is described often in the suttas. And it's in that kind of natural flowing way. And sometimes the analogy of the water flowing down the river is used specifically, that kind of language, to talk about how one quality of practice or quality flows into the next. And so, for example, associating with good people. This one example where this sequence flows one to the next. And it begins with associating with good people. So here's where you have to assert effort. You find yourself some good people to hang out with. And and so that's your job. And So find some good people, and I think the little bit the assumption the good people also means people who can hear the Dharma from, hear Dharma talk or talk the Dharma with, because then it says, if you associate with good people, this flows into hearing the Dharma. If you hear the Dharma, this flows into being, to becoming confident, being inspired. If you get confident, this flows into becoming aware, a heightened attentiveness, being attentive. As you become attentive, this flows into heightened mindfulness. As you become mindful, this flows into safeguarding yourself at the senses, at the sense doors. So if you have all these things going, then if you go around the world, you're going to be careful that as you see and hear and touch things, that it doesn't trigger you to get attached or reactive to it. It just flows. Of course you wouldn't do it. And then if you are safeguarding yourself with the senses, then it flows into three kinds of good conduct, which it doesn't explain in the text, but it's probably of speech, of body and mind, body, speech and mind. So you kind of start being ethical. If you have practiced these three good conducts, then this will flow into the four foundations of mindfulness. If the four foundations of mindfulness are there, this will flow into the seven factors of awakening. And if the seven factors of awakening are there, this flows into liberation. And in the analogy, it goes kind of parallel to the mountain and rain thing. And the ocean, it would be liberation, to finally come into the great ocean. And if you know about if you imagine rainwater coming on top of a mountain, making little creeks and streams and rivers, higher up, when it's kind of small perhaps and kind of steep, there are rapids and it's gurgling and churning and white water and, you know, makes a lot of noise. But when the rivers get really, really big, it usually gets not so steep anymore, and they get really quiet, you know, and you're kind of more peaceful to watch. And then when you go all the way out onto the ocean, at least from a distance, the ocean is really peaceful. That's why they call it the Pacific, right? So this idea that as you know, initially there might be a lot of energy and excitement and like this to hear the Dharma and get all fired up with confidence. Maybe it's like a little bit in the rapids or something. They're going over the boulders and making a lot of noise. Some people who hear the Dharma and get too excited or make too much noise for their friends. But the people who, you know, once you get really established in it and you're down on the plains and the big river and it's quiet and peaceful and confident in a different kind of way, like, you know. So this idea of flowing one into the other. What responsibility do we have? What do we do? Because, you know, in this example, we put ourselves having good friends, associate with good people. The suttas describe a variety of different things can give birth to this process. One of the things that gives birth to this process is, the primary practices that are described that sets these things into motion, create the conditions for the rising of this sequence of stuff, are primarily practices of what you don't do and practices of knowing. So Inez yesterday talked about abandoning. We abandon the hindrances, we abandon things. Restraint of the senses has a lot to do about what you don't do. You don't get caught up in the things of the world. So it's a lot about what you don't do. And the reason, part of the emphasis on that is that when you have the rainwater on the mountain and it flows down the mountain, it's going to flow all the way down unless something obstructs it. And so, same thing with us. If there's something that obstructs the natural unfolding, opening of the heart, then it doesn't flow anymore. But if we can abandon or get rid of the obstructions, remove the obstruction, no longer have it obstructing, then this process continues. So again, I see it as being a very, very positive view of human nature, that given, if there's nothing in the way, that the human heart, the human mind will unfold in this beautiful way, moving towards freedom. Some of you know that I have an analogy I like to use for what I call the biological imperative for liberation. And it's kind of a little bit reductionalistic, but kind of gives the sense, maybe a little bit of understanding of how this can be a natural process that's within us. And that is, if you make a really hard fist and try to hold it for a long, long time, you have to constantly reassert yourself. You have to remind yourself, because there's very strong tendency in the fist, in the hand, to want to relax, to release. It requires continued vigilance and effort to keep making that hard, hard, tight fist. There's no intentionality in the fist exactly, but in a sense, what the fist wants to do is to relax. And only by getting in the way of that, by reasserting the tightness, do we keep it from relaxing. So the tendency of the hand is to want to become free and open. So the same thing with our hearts and minds. It takes effort and energy to be tight, to be contracted, to be holding on to resentments, to be holding on to anger, to be holding on to greed, grasping down. And because it takes effort to kind of hold on tight, to cling, the movement is towards relaxation. Movement is towards not making that kind of effort. So there's a natural tendency in the mind to want to relax and open up. Unless we keep reasserting the clinging, or the grasping, or the resistance, whatever we have. And so this emphasis the Buddha gave on letting go is not because the Buddha was a real party pooper, you know, a real downer, you know, like, you know, that's all he can talk about is letting go. I mean, you know, I mean, this guy, you know, what's wrong with him? But rather it's because it's actually a very positive view of human nature, that of what gets in the way of really beautiful things arising and occurring, if we can get out of the way. So one of the things is, one of the practices that's often taught then, a lot of what he focuses on is letting go, one form or the other. The second practice that he talked about a lot was knowing, mindfulness, awareness. And many different kind of words he used in that category, like observing, knowing, seeing, you know, all kinds of things. But it's all in the category of knowing what's there. And in both these primary categories of practices, there's nothing said about making something happen. You know, like you're going to do something. You do this thing. Even the famous practice of mindfulness, you'd be hard to find anywhere in the suttas where the Buddha says, be mindful, do mindfulness. Even though teachers like me say, be mindful. You know, but the Buddha never said, be mindful. What he did was, he saw mindfulness, this thing sati, as something that arose naturally, provided that you knew what was going on in the moment, if you're observing what's going on in the moment. So he reserved words like observe and know for what we do, but mindfulness was something that arose, that we give birth to. Isn't that interesting? So whatever you think mindfulness is probably just fine. Keep doing it. But there is something that gets born in this process. And it seems to be a natural process, that if you do these things. And I wanted to read one passage that describes this natural process. And the word that Bhikkhu Bodhi in the translator, it translates this particular Pali word as natural. It is natural. And the word is dhammata. It's the word dharma, and the ta at the end means a kind of abstract noun like dharma-ness. It's the Dharma's, in this context, he feels quite comfortable translating it's natural. For a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous. So if you live ethically, then you don't have to kind of, make yourself feel, without regret. It's natural not to have regret if you're living virtuously. Of course, the Buddha didn't live in modern America. So, because here in America, you can have regret even if you didn't do anything, even if for no reason at all. You can be guilty, you could be fundamentally wrong. We're much more creative here than in ancient India. But in ancient India, that was, it seemed like it was a little simpler, and so it was just natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person. And also, no volition need be exerted. So you don't have to even wish it or try to. You don't have the intention for this. It'll just arise. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. And then he goes on, it is natural for joy, it is natural if someone has joy for, I'm a little confused myself. Joy arises. For one who is joyful, tranquility arises. For one who is tranquil, pleasure arises, or the word is sukha, happiness. For one who is has happiness, becomes concentrated. For one who is concentrated, when one is concentrated, one knows and sees things as they are. It is natural that one who knows and sees things as they are becomes disenchanted and dispassionate. It is natural for one who is disenchanted and dispassionate to realize knowledge and vision of liberation. So here we see this kind of it's natural, it's a flow, and you don't have to even want to do it. And there's another analogy the Buddha gave for this kind of idea of a chicken. The chicken sits on her eggs and incubates the eggs. The chicken doesn't cause the eggs to develop inside the eggs, but she makes the ideal conditions with her warmth for it to happen. And then the Buddha said, the chicken does not need to, even if the chicken wishes that the chicks do not hatch. It means it doesn't want them to hatch because she likes sitting on eggs. Then the chicks will hatch anyway. So same way for ourselves, he said, if you create the conditions for your practice in a certain way, then you don't have to even bother with wishing to get liberated. It's natural that you'll become liberated if the conditions are there. I think that's lovely, isn't it? So, don't get too caught up with this whole liberation thing. But do get caught up in creating the conditions for it. So one of the, in our mindfulness tradition, one of the conditions that we emphasize a lot is knowing or observing, really seeing what's there. And then the not obstructing it, not getting in the way of what's there, I like to think of it as whatever happens, whatever's going on, saying yes to it. Saying yes. So not that you approve of it necessarily, but rather a kind of a willingness to step forward and say, yes, I'll be with this. Yes, I'll kind of open to this. Yes, I'll open to this. Let's open to this too. that's open to this. So knowing what's happening and then being willing to open to it, not to obstruct it, not to block it, not to close around it, not to try to fix it. If you're trying to fix something, if you're trying to make something go away too much, or you're trying to make something happen, like get concentrated, if you're too much taking responsibility, it probably just interferes with the whole process. You have to sometimes go in the wrong direction to go forward, right? And one of the wrong, so-called wrong direction for efficient people is not to do and try to make and take responsibility for what's supposed to happen, but rather take responsibility to create the conditions for it. And what I'm suggesting is that a shorthand for a big part of Buddhist practice is the practice of saying yes, seeing what's there, recognizing what's happening, and just go yes, and open to it and feel it. So if, for example, you are sitting here and being unconcentrated, notice that you're not concentrated, and say, and just kind of like, you don't have to do this with your hands or anything, but kind of, you know, in your heart, oh yes, I'm not concentrated. What's this like? Let me get to know this better. What's this experience like? If your mind is really spinning out, don't fight it. Say, once you recognize the mind is spinning, go, yes. It's a great story of and the suttas of a young idealistic monk, maybe, who asked the Buddha to go off and meditate. And the Buddha says, it's not quite right time for you to go. But he asked the Buddha three times. And if you ask the Buddha three times, he kind of has to say yes. So, but the Buddha knew better, right? And so, the guy went off to meditate. And the guy comes back after some time and he says to the Buddha, it's marvelous. It's wonderful how I couldn't get concentrated. The Buddha probably said, yeah, I told you. what I like is this, it's marvelous, it's wonderful. As opposed to, oh, I can't believe my, you know, it's awful, you know. It was so bad, I was miserable, and it's embarrassing to come back, and it's embarrassing to come back and talk to you, you know, you told me I shouldn't go. And, you know, I really blew it. But rather, it's marvelous, it's wonderful. My mind couldn't get concentrated. It's kind of like this yes practice. You're open to the experience, keep opening. So if you are in pain, there's an art to saying yes to that. It doesn't mean that you don't, you know, if you're injuring yourself, you shouldn't say, you don't say yes to injuring yourself unless the injury is unavoidable. If it's completely unavoidable, then say yes. But don't injure yourself. But if there's, you know, ordinary pain sitting here, you can say yes and then open to it as opposed to no and contract. I learned a lot about saying no to pain in my early years of practice. And I slowly learned to notice that I had a lot of knee pain. And it was reasonable, right, to say no to knee pain. That's what I had my whole life up to that point. You said no to pain. And the idea that you say yes to pain was a completely foreign idea. But I sat with so much of it, I started to see that every time I said no, every time I resisted it, the little muscles around my knee would tighten up and it would hurt more. And it hurt, and one of the conditions that particularly got those muscles kind of contracting was self-pity. Poor Gil. Oh, oh, poor Gil. Oh, it's so hard. Doesn't anyone care? And then I could just watch, you know. I said, do that little self-pity thing, and it would tighten up the muscles. So it wasn't like I wanted to let go of self-pity because it's a good, you know, it's like a good run. You know, at least we think it's good. But out of you know, great need, I had to let go of it, because otherwise it wasn't sustainable. I couldn't stay there anymore with the meditation unless I let go of the self-pity, because the pain was so strong. But then it was manageable if I didn't have self-pity. So yes. And then part of this process that the Buddha repeatedly talks about is the birth of gladness. And I kind of like it that the translators in English translate as gladness, because I don't really know what gladness is exactly. I mean, I have a good connection to joy and to happiness, but gladness, like what? What is that? And so it's much more open. So when you say yes, it's like there's possibilities then. You know, just, you know, if you think you know what it is, then it's a little harder sometimes. But but I think of it as one of the ways I think of it is appreciation. So to give birth to appreciation. And I think it's fair that for most people, there's always something you can appreciate. And for a lot of people, especially in a situation like a retreat center, there's probably a lot to appreciate. Which I didn't appreciate anything when I was in my early retreat centers, when I was wallowing in self-pity. You know, what world out there? But there was lots to appreciate, so to appreciate yourself, to appreciate the chance you have, opportunity to practice, to appreciate you're practicing with good people, appreciate you're getting teachings that hopefully are useful, appreciate that that work that you have to do is supporting the practice hopefully and not, you know, taking you away from it. Appreciating maybe the chance of being in a nice environment. There's a lot of things to appreciate. Appreciating the Dharma, the practice itself. And then to be nourished by that. So it's kind of yes. And kind of be nourished, be supported, be buoyed by that. Let that kind of help that for the heart to sing. Oh yes, this is good. Not to be Pollyannish, not to deny that things are hard and difficult and painful and struggles with different things, and that you can't let go of some of the strong tendency of the mind so easily that you have. But to overemphasize the difficulties you have, to overemphasize the psychological challenges and shortcomings that you have, seems to be a particular feature of, as far as I can tell, of Western culture. 100 years of psychology in the West has made many of us psychologically sophisticated. So we know how bad we are. to make space and room for appreciation is yes. And that you can try the yes practice, and you might discover in the process of it how it highlights all the no's, all the ways in which you don't make space and room for appreciation. You don't make space and room for just taking in the moment for what it is. And often the present moment is much better than we think. Even when it's difficult, so-called, you know, just yes, here. So when the Buddha talked about the course of practice, he often talked about this gladness, or I call it appreciation, being part of what sets in motion this natural unfolding. So can we put in place the conditions and then benefit from the conditions where these things can unfold? And I think some modicum of appreciation is needed. So what are the conditions that put into place? I'd like to suggest that all of you did a fantastic job when you came to IRC to create the conditions for something to appreciate. It's awesome what we've managed to do here, right? I think it's pretty fantastic. I appreciate it. And so that's the conditions we all put together, right? So I appreciate it. You know, that's an amazing thing. And maybe with that appreciation creates a kind of context for how to hold the difficulties you have, the challenge you have, that kind of makes it lighter or easier to go through, or kind of leavens it, or makes it easier to be honest, makes it easier to be courageous, to stay present for whatever's happening, makes it easier and more to let your tears flow if you need to cry, makes it easier to allow yourself to feel your fear that maybe you've never felt before and really allowed for. And it's okay, you can, there's space for the fear because you're in an environment that is supportive of it. So you can say yes to these difficult things that maybe you've never said yes to them. Say yes to your fear. Well, just what is that like? Yes. One of the great important conditions to help fear participate in this natural process of healing and unfolding and movement towards liberation is to see if you can help your fear feel safe. Have you ever thought of that? Your poor fear. Help your fear feel safe. Say yes to it and make space for it and allow for it. And then perhaps something can begin to unfold. The powers of healing, the power of unfolding that exists in our hearts and mind are powerful. Your heart knows how to take care of yourself if you get out of the way, if you allow it to. It takes a lot of honesty, takes a lot of truth with what's here. But as you say, as you really see what's here and recognize what's here and admit what's here, then say yes and open to it and make space for it. And so this making your fear safe is to make space for it. Give it its time. If you're angry, say yes to it, open to it. But best to do it without moving. I was in the one of the probably the last time in my life where I wanted to punch someone out. Was in the Zen monastery in Japan. The monk who sat next to me, right there. And he really had it out for me, and he was constantly bullying me and irritating me and teasing me. And even during meditation, we'd be sitting there, and he was like poking me. And he didn't like me. But luckily, I was committed to sitting still, because it would have been pretty bad for me if I'd punched him out in the meditation hall. So it's good, you know, but you know, if you can stay still or the equivalent, it's really great in practice to let your rage come. If that's what needs to come, say yes to it. It's okay. It's okay. It's actually sometimes very empowering to let these things flow. It's good. And appreciate the chance. Hopefully appreciate. Now, one of the ways that this works, this yes and opening to it, is that the very act of opening is itself a healthy thing. The very act of opening has a quality or feeling inside of it of lightening or appreciation or kind of easing or relaxing or, you know, something in and of itself. It's like when I release the fist, the releasing feels good. It's just in and of itself. So this yes and opening to the experience, that in itself can feel good. Allow yourself to feel that. Oh, that feels so much better. And if you have doubts that it feels better, go the opposite direction. Contract better. You know, should really tighten up and resist it and see what that feels like. And chances are that won't feel as good. Feel the goodness of opening to your challenges. Feel the goodness of opening to the blessings you have. Sit there. Part of the art of doing this is, in terms of meditation practice and here, is to try to do it without then giving birth to a lot of thinking. a lot of discursive thoughts. So it isn't like appreciation, then start thinking about all the list of things you appreciate and what you're going to do and who you're going to tell and everything. But there's an art to saying yes and letting the mind get quiet. Part of the opening, to really be open to the experience, is to allow the mind to become quiet. It's kind of like if you're listening to a sound far away, or if you really want to savor something, like a flavor, sometimes we close our eyes and let the thinking mind get really quiet so we can really kind of take it in. So this yes and open, see if the thinking mind can become quiet, even if it's just for a couple of seconds, so you can really take it in, really register it, really feel the experience. And that also then supports the quieting of the mind, quieting the mind. And the quieter the mind becomes as we become more open, paying attention, the more then it gives birth to, it allows for the flow and the growth of what's called the seven factors of awakening. And the Buddha, when he talked about, one of the times he talked specifically about what are the skillful qualities that we want to give birth to in this scheme of the four right efforts, is the seven factors of awakening. So we say yes, open, and are interested in what's there, like really know it better, and that's mindfulness. And then with a quiet mind, almost a silent mind, really, what is this experience? And that really, what is it? To feel, that's investigation. And in that kind of and then kind of really to give yourself over to that, to really be there for it, requires some energy. The third factor of awakening. To really engage with your experience, to really be there and be present, in this schema, gives birth to some kind of joy or happiness or well-being. It feels good to be engaged, but good to be really present for the experience. If you get out of the way of experience, but really are present for it, open to it, it gives birth to a certain kind of joy. And then that kind of good joy can help us relax. We don't have to start trusting the process, trusting that something's moving through us. We don't have to try so much, and it's okay to relax. And that's a tranquility factor of awakening. As things get relaxed and tranquil, gives birth to some kind of well-being that the tradition calls sukha, happiness. Kind of a deeper abiding sense of happiness that's kind of like the big wide, it's quiet, like the big wide river on the plains that just kind of moves along and you hardly hear anything at all compared to the rivers, you know, up in the mountains that are noisy. And then really being that kind of deep, contented happiness, then that gives birth to the factor, enlightenment factor of concentration. And I think of concentration as a deep stability, a deep composure, being really composed and steadied on our experience. It's not that being up in the control tower, boring down the experience, but really settled and composed and steadied on what's happening. Just steady right here with this breath. And then this gives birth to, concentration like this gives birth to the equanimity factor of awakening. And the equanimity factor is the quality of the mind where you can really be present for the experience. Really present because you're concentrated, you're steadied on the experience, really open to it, completely available to the experience as it rises and passes, it's there. But the mind's not going to react for or against. It's not going to move towards it, it's not going to pull away, it's not going to shrink, it's not going to explode. It just, the mind is quiet, kind of like the ocean maybe. If you've ever been swimming underwater, below the waves, it's so quiet sometimes there, so still. So we want to support the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. That's the third of the four right efforts. To allow for the arising of skillful qualities that are not here yet. And the suggestion I have is that you don't make anything arise that's really, you know, the real movements of the practice, but you make space for it to arise. You allow for it to arise. And so in order to allow for it to arise, there has to be some willingness to step out of the way, some willingness to allow something to arise that's different than anything you can expect or want. There has to be some willingness to open to the unknown, to let the unknown have a chance to come up out of you and bubble up and be there. You don't know what needs to arise, but I know that if you do this practice, if you're honest and present, say yes and open to what's here, that you can trust whatever it is that arises, whatever comes, and then just keep opening to it, to the yes to this, to open to this. And if you need a little extra help, if that's not quite enough for you, then you can sprinkle in a good dosage of relax. Open and relax. Just kind of be present to this, to this. So maybe you don't have to be so responsible. Maybe you don't have to be so to make something happen. But you can be responsible for putting the conditions in place. And the condition, two primary conditions that I'm suggesting today is to know clearly what's happening in the present moment. And whatever is obviously happening here, observe, see it, know it, be present for it. And then the second thing is to say yes to it. Open to it. Yes, you know. Open your arms wide and say, you know, be available. Be vulnerable. Be tender. Make space for. Be receptive for. And then that will create the conditions for something to happen. Something else will arise. And then you start over again. Know what that is. And say yes to that and open to that. All the while, see if you can let the mind become quieter. You don't need to have discursive thoughts. You don't need to have commentary. It's okay just to kind of keep kind of being present, feeling, sensing, knowing the experience for what it is. So in conclusion, I think this kind of teachings that the Buddha gave points to a very positive view of human nature, that there's inherent goodness, inherent movements towards what's really beautiful inside of us. And it's waiting for you. What's inside of you is waiting. And it's a wonderful thing that's in there. And you have to go through your process, but it's there. And it can gladden the mind to have this, you know, understand, oh yeah, there's something really good here. And it's a natural thing. You're kind of born with it. And then we want to make space for it and let it grow and develop. So let's take a minute or so to get back into the meditation posture and close your eyes maybe, and kind of, we do this often at retreats at the end of a talk. It's a way of regathering ourselves and recollecting ourselves and getting back into more the mindfulness mode of the retreat.